Hello, my name is Chris Malmberg, and this is the Book Spider Podcast, a podcast about books that is so recursive and insular as to seem sometimes like its own Ouroboros human centipede, by which I mean I dig my own shit. And I hope you do too. I'm joined by my always co-hosts, Hans Berger and Patrick Barney. Today we're discussing the 2009 novel and its 2014 film adaptation, Inherent Vice, by Thomas Pynchon and Paul Thomas Anderson, respectively. Set in 1970s Los Angeles, Inherent Vice follows Larry Doc Sportello, a private investigator who spends most of his time stoned. The story begins when his ex-girlfriend Shasta Faye Hepworth shows up at his beach place looking for help, dealing with a plot to commit her current lover, real estate developer Mickey Wolfman, to a mental institution. Doc agrees to look into it, but very quickly both Shasta and Mickey disappear. What starts as a missing persons case quickly explodes into a vast hallucinatory tangle. Doc's snooping leads him through 1,000 different actors, each trying to survive, subjugate, fix, or repair L.A. in their own ways. There's the Indochinese heroin syndicate called the Golden Fang, which might also be a cartel of dentists, the neo-Nazi biker gang, the Black Gorilla family, the FBI, a dead and then resurrected federal informant saxophone player, and even zombie and or vampire musicians. Throughout his investigation, he's harassed by LAPD detective Bigfoot Bjornsson, who seems to hate everything Doc represents about the counterculture, but also can't quite leave Doc alone. The story operates as both a detective noir and a chronicle of the counterculture's final days, when the idealism of the 1960s was giving way to paranoia, disillusionment, and capitalism. Everything feels hazy, dangerous, and even a little bit forlorn, partly because of Doc's perpetual pot fog, and also maybe because the world around him genuinely does seem to be full of shadowy connections and hidden agendas. PTA's 2014 film adaptation keeps a lot of the story and even quite a bit of its dialogue, word for word. But some of subplots and minor characters get cut, looking at you, Lemuria. And I think it's quite a bit more coherent as a result. Is it better? I don't know. Maybe we'll talk about that. They also, book and movie end on slightly different notes. The movie putting a bit more work into closure between Shasta and Doc, as well as between Bigfoot and Doc. I said that we might talk, or I said that I wasn't sure whether the movie is better than the book or not. That's maybe not a very rich question to mine, but it is sort of stemming off of something that Hans said when I brought this week's reading and viewing up. Hans, you said that Inherent Vice might be one rare property where the movie is an improvement on the novel. I'm curious, after reading and watching them again, do you still feel that way? And after that, Patrick, how do you feel?
Yeah, so I do think that reading this again, I do still think probably that certainly at a gut level, at an emotional level, I really like the movie a lot. I'm very, very fond of it. And I could kind of, I don't want to say I could take or leave Inherent Vice, but I definitely am. I remember when this came out, you know, there were some folks who were fans of Pynchon who were disappointed because they saw it as being slight and underambitious. I remember the university that we all were going to grad school at, there was a Pynchon specialist in the department, on the faculty. And you and I asked him how he felt about this not too long after it came out. And he basically asked, you know, he acted as though I had like walked in with a dog shit on my shoe and said, "Hey Terry, what do you think of this?" He really didn't like it. And there were other people that I read about, at least I don't think I knew any personally, but there were other people that I read about who really appreciated that Pynchon was adding something more accessible and approachable and just kind of more purely fun to his body of work. And I think at the time I probably was more in the former camp, and honestly, like I'm, or sorry, at the time I was one of the folks who was more pleased to see a kind of a slimmer, more approachable Pynchon. I think coming at it now, having lived with the bigger novels for 15 years or so, I don't love this book very much, and I adore the movie. And I think that I'm trying to think of why that is, and the best explanation I can come up with is just that, you know, the book has, it has that quality where if you open it to any random page and kind of just find any random line, you'll probably find something clever or funny or interesting or well-phrased. Like, there's a whole bunch of good stuff in it, you know? And it, if you read it kind of slowly over time, it's possible, I think, to appreciate a lot of small stuff, but there's a way that to me it's never felt like it's always felt like one of those things where the parts don't really add up to the sum that you would hope they would. And I think it's because what makes the movie work better, you know, the movie keeps, as you've noted, Chris, a lot of the best and most memorable dialogue. Even some of the narration, that the character of Sœur de Liège becomes a narrator who is kind of a synthesis both of the Sœur de Liège in the book and also just saying the third person narration from the book. Most of the plots, the most effective plot material is retained, but there's something about the vividness of image and something about the kind of emotional depth that an actor provides that just kind of gives the material a sense of blood and intensity and humanity that it doesn't have on the page, even though the page is almost kind of like the unedited screenplay for the movie, you know? For whatever reason, like Pynchon, the material on the page really has kind of like a kind of flatness to it. And the addition of music and visuals and the charisma of actors kind of brings it to life. And I think in most cases, obviously any movie, you're going to have those advantages, but you're going to have the disadvantage of the loss of the power of prose and the imaginative space that it creates. And Anderson managed to kind of retain those aspects in this adaptation and then keep the things that make film a distinct medium, and in some ways, if not a more powerful one, than a more immediate one.
Patrick, how do you feel?
Man, I hate the position that I'm currently in. Oh.
That makes me so happy to hear. Go ahead.
I hate the position I'm in because I don't want to be the one here defending the book.
Patrick, I like the book. So you're not going to be on your own. Go ahead.
All right. I think that the book is better than the movie. Definitely. I think that there are at least a couple things in the movie that are significantly worse than the book. To my mind, the portrayal of Doc's relationship with Shasta feels more muted in the book. He is less the page, the Doc on the page is more ambivalent, less head over heels, less concerned about what's happening to Shasta than the movie version. That feels created to me by Paul Thomas Anderson, like this Doc's investment in Shasta's well-being feels stronger in the movie, and I think that makes the story worse. I think it makes Doc more of a, like, in the book, it feels like Doc is investigating Shasta's disappearance because he is, in fact, a stalwart. He is steadfast. He is a member of the community trying to make sure that the community is not run over or destroyed. And his way of doing that is to, you know, kind of just be this random helper of people in the community. And in the movie, it felt more like he really was a spurned ex-lover, tortured by this past, which I didn't like as much. Also, I mean, come on. In the movie, the awesome, the really cool, like, confrontation at the end, where Doc has something to say to the what's his name, Japonica's dad, Crocker, where he's like, yeah, you're a capitalist piece of shit. That's cut out of the movie. That's in the movie, he's just like, well, tut tut. I mean, okay, like, maybe it's funny, but like, I really disliked that the movie kind of mutes the critique of capitalism and hierarchy that is very plain and apparent in the book, and is one of the reasons that I enjoyed the book mostly. I felt like the setup of Doc's the symbol of Doc as the kind of capable anarchist that doesn't need hierarchy, next to Bjornsson, who is you know, totally invested in hierarchy. The contrast is stronger in the book and more, just more present and more laid out. So I definitely think that for those two reasons at least, the film is worse. And there's also, you know, like, I did like some of the extra details that the film left out. And in fact, I watched the film first a long time ago, and remember not liking it that much, thinking, it's kind of, I didn't think it was that great. I didn't think that the plot was that intriguing. But on the page, it seemed to work a lot better. Like the connections were more explicit. Now I will say that one of the big things that irritates me about this book, I like this book, but one thing that irritates me about this book is how much turns on just pure coincidences, which it kind of makes it less tense. But without all the extra detail, the movie seemed more to turn on those coincidences. That's my spiel.
That's a pretty good argument, actually. Like I mean, Chris, I'll let you kind of take back over in a moment. I just wanted to say that is actually a pretty articulate critique, I think, of how the book is thematically more effective and powerful than the movie. I like that.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I think the professor that you mentioned on to did not think very much of the book. I think one of the things that he said, I think that you and I were together when this was brought up. I'm not sure. Maybe
I think we were, yeah.
Maybe two separate, yeah. I think he suggested that Pynchon and Bob Dylan lived together in California, and this was just basically a bunch of cobbled together notes from that time, and that Pynchon's wife made him publish it. I'm not sure how much of that is, you know, really like true or anything like that. I think that it was probably scuttlebutt, you know, in the nascent forums of Thomas Pynchonians online, coming up with, you know, theories for why it wasn't a big doorstopper like Against the Day and, you know, more ambitious or whatever. But I do think that there is something to how fragmented the novel is. I mean, you know, Patrick, you mentioned plot. I don't think that there's much of a plot, really. Like, you know, like it doesn't, it's not really plot driven. And I wonder if the movie, to make it function as a movie, and I don't really disparage the movie for this. I think that like PTA was trying to kind of hang this very shaggy thing in a much more sort of shoebox shaped medium. And to make it work, you got more of the sort of romantic relationship. You're absolutely right, I think, Patrick.
Right.
With Shasta, we even end with a kind of a hint of them together, though it's somewhat ambiguous whether, you know,
right,
that's a good or a bad or an anything thing.
I mean, it's definitely bad. And she's horrible. She's a mercurial, awful, not like I did not want.
She's pretty good looking for someone so horrible. I mean, like, you kind of eat a little bit of that horror to spend some time with Shasta Faye Hepworth.
That's Hollywood. I mean, I definitely like in the book that Doc doesn't, there's not any hint that he's hooking back up with her. Like, you know, I don't want, she seems like not good for him at all, you know, like, she seems like she would only lead him to more pain. So why put him back in that spot?
But Patrick, it's that good kind of pain. I mean, really,
it's the terrible, terrible pain.
The other thing that the movie does is really, I think, try to expand on the sort of almost partner buddy cop sort of like odd couple angle of Doc and Bigfoot that I think is much more buried in the complexity of the novel. Like, a movie just can't be shaggy in the way that a novel can. So I really don't disparage the movie. I think this happens quite a bit. I'm kind of between you guys. I like both the novel and the movie. But, you know, hearing you talk about it, both of you talk about it, I think that, like, the movie, in trying to make it work better for a movie, PTA sort of restructures it where there's kind of a series of climaxes in the movie. There's Japonica's dad, you know, Crocker, getting Koi out. There's hooking up with Shasta, and, you know, and there's also the scene, or there's Adrian Prussia and Puck. But I'd say that, like, the kind of emotional sort of, like, other side to that particular climax is the confrontation with Bigfoot at the end, where Bigfoot eats all of Doc's, you know, weed. And that's not really present. It's sort of cobbled together from a couple different things, and it's not really present in the same way in the novel. And it honestly, like, I both admire it for its sort of cinematic quality. Like, it's like just like this very interesting, strange moment. And it is, I think, building off of the strange entanglement of both Bigfoot and Doc that is there in both the book and the movie. But I actually think it doesn't work at all. Like, I don't know what the fuck Doc is apologizing for. Literally, Bigfoot just
tried to have him killed and set up.
Try to have him killed and set up. And then, like, they both apologize at the same time, and I don't understand it. And it's like I think it's not really Paul Thomas Anderson's original sin, though. It's really that pinch on, like, whether this is just a bunch of cobbled together notes or not, Bigfoot is, I don't know what to do. I like Bigfoot as a character, but, like, the whole arc with Bigfoot and Doc is not really, it's not really the arc that I think that it's sort of dressed up as in the movie.
Right. It seems way more adversarial in the book, like, just pure.
Yeah. Pure. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's my one big critique of the movie is, like, I I've seen it a few times now because I fucking love the movie. I really love the movie. I really like the book.
I liked the movie more after reading the book than I did the first time.
Okay.
I understood it. Like, after reading the book, I understood the movie better and felt a little more tense and a little more interested. But I do still think the book is superior.
I think they probably actually work pretty well in tandem with each other, even though I was a little bit mean to the book at the beginning. I think that, like, they probably work better in tandem with each other than a lot of book and movie pairs would, right? Because they each account for the other's weaknesses, right? The book accounts for the movie's thematic shallowness. The book makes the movie easier to track. But the movie, I still think, I don't know, like in when the opening credits start and Vitamin C by Can starts playing, like that, there's a kind of texture of feeling that just immediately kicks in, that there's nothing like that the book can really sum up, you know?
Well, I do agree that, like, the movie has, you know, images of Gordita Beach. There's something about the imagistic nature of it that, like, captures the area and the time in a way that the book doesn't. So I certainly agree on that front.
I totally understand why you would both be maybe not that pleased with how Shasta is handled in the movie, right? That the need to kind of, for one thing, that your point, Patrick, that the way that Doc appears to be working for Shasta out of some kind of residual lust or adoration rather than out of diligence and competence. Like, I do think that the part of the idea of the book is that Doc is actually a dedicated and competent character who is truly respected even by Bigfoot. And you have to have read the book, I think, to understand that that's happening in the movie. And I do agree that the way that the relationship with Shasta is handled is maybe detrimental to that, and I can see why that would be troublesome. I think also that that last scene where they're in the car together, the first time I watched the movie, I remember thinking, oh, this isn't a happy ending at all. They're damned, right? And the second time I watched the movie, I thought, oh no, that's a completely happy ending. They've been through all this and they've kind of rediscovered whatever it was that brought them together originally. And she's kind of purged the bad things in her soul that drew her to Mickey. And then when I watched it last night, I just thought, well, I don't really know. You know, there's something deeply enigmatic and ambiguous about that moment at the level of performance, at the level of just everything. And I do appreciate that. And I can see, even though it's thematically less, I think, noble and admirable, right, than how Pynchon handled that relationship, I do want to acknowledge why I think that that would be, you know, relative to the capabilities of film, right? Because all the ambiguity, all the enigma of that is entirely conveyed through filmmaking tools. And I just wanted to kind of say that I do appreciate, while totally understanding your critiques, I do appreciate the kind of depth of that moment, and I like it.
It's funny, you bringing up the ending reminded me, I didn't put this into my summary or my questions because I don't know that it goes anywhere, but this last viewing I was really paying attention to, like, how to read that, and it did feel ambiguous in the end to me, and buried in there I couldn't tell if this is just me, because I actually recently rewatched this, but have either of you seen Taxi Driver? The final scene,
that fucking great movie that is an important cinematic landmark. Yes, I've seen it.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah,
I love Taxi Driver, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, one of the last things we get in that movie is this, like, really, like, elevated moment where the main character is looking back at us through the rearview mirror. And it seemed like we were the rearview mirror in Inherent Vice and Doc. Like, there's a kind of extended couple seconds where he's like looking at us. And I don't know if that was some sort of filmic illusion. I don't know what to make of that connection, but, you know, a kind of a shootout and a kind of some sort of reconciliation and driving at night and glancing into, you know, a rear view mirror, but also looking directly into the eyes of the audience or the gaze of the audience. It seemed like PTA would know that, but anyway, Patrick, I was going to ask, you mentioned the critique of capitalism and, you know, how effective, you know, are you convinced, Patrick, that capitalism is bad? But
no. Are you more convinced than you were before you read this novel? I think that's the
yeah. Crux. Well, I'm just I mean, like, well, as someone who like Hans and I are tourists in the like political critique realm. You live there, so tell us, like, how effective is this?
It's pretty effective. One thing that I really like about this novel is that it, you know, I think Pynchon, I don't know, I've never read anything about him personally, so I'm just going off of the three novels I've read by him, The Crying of Lot 49, this one, and Against the Day. But he seems to be more of an anarchist than, say, a Marxist-Leninist, which is what I'm closer to. I'm closer to an anarchist as well. So the anarchist critique of capitalism is at least partially that it is hierarchical, right? Like, hierarchy to the anarchist is bad, and like, there are tons of things that capitalism does that is terrible, you know, exploitation and, you know, forced poverty and things like this. But the anarchist says that this occurs because it is a hierarchical system, whereas the Marxist-Leninist is more, you know, says that, you know, their history has these stages and yada, 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 and we go through these class struggles and all that. Not that I necessarily disagree with this, but as a metaphor for capitalism as hierarchy, like the problems of hierarchy within capitalism, or I think that's super cool in this novel. Like, as I said earlier, like you know, Bigfoot being like the symbol of what is of a character invested in hierarchy and thinks that hierarchy is good, and Doc, kind of the capable anarchist, you know, that contrast is really nice. And, you know, obviously, you know, I imagine that most anarchists think that, you know, poverty is horrible, right? Like, the, you know, it's not like anarchists think that capitalists having all the money and workers not having money is good just because we critique it from a different angle. But that critique of hierarchy is what really strikes me as super good about this novel. You know, like the culture in which Doc finds himself is very mutualistic, and as I said, he's like a stalwart in the community. So, you know, I feel like I'm repeating myself, but, you know, that's the basic idea that I think is super successful.
the line that, that pops out into my head is, and it's in both the book and the movie. It's Crocker. Is it Fenway? Crocker Fenway?
Mm-hmm.
Japonica's dad. Crocker says, "You people lose all respect as soon as you pay rent." And there is a way in which, like, that feels like, at least as I heard it and read it, like the capitalist structures that the people, the stoners and the deadbeats and the, you know, musicians and the pussy eaters and all of them, you know, have to participate in, the tier of capitalism that they have to participate in necessitates that they sort of go against their espoused values and actually like pay for things. And on some tier of society, that's not even what capitalism is. Like people at Crocker's level, at the Golden Fang level, at the whatever level, Mickey Wolfman, they don't pay for stuff in the same way. And I don't know, maybe that's me misreading it, but it struck me as a really, it struck me as a kind of a linchpin for what the book may or may not be saying about, you know, what the book may be saying about how unfair the system is.
I don't want to keep coming back to the Shasta scene, but to kind of connect that to some of what you're both saying and to my sense of Pynchon's project on a larger scope, I haven't read Bleeding Edge recently, and I haven't read Shadow Ticket, but every other Pynchon book, as I understand it, particularly kind of the like the key works, and I would include this, every Pynchon book is about a moment in history when a window of opportunity for freedom and essentially what you would, I think, recognize, Patrick, as an anarchist vision. Every Pynchon book is about a moment in history when a window of opportunity for true freedom and an anarchist vision is subsumed, overtaken, collapsed under the reassertion of authority and of authoritarian systems. And in a certain way, I feel like that moment, that kind of, that moment when Shasta and Doc are driving away and she seems to have given herself back to him, and it feels initially sweet, and then the more you sit with it, deeply ominous. Like that, in a, that that's almost kind of taking that idea and bringing it down just to the level of two people in a car, right? You know, you have this person who is rooted in this community of freedom and autonomy, who has kind of let himself be this fundamentally kind of other, probably a little bit evil person who I think in her soul is drawn to those authoritarian systems and probably really hasn't purged that in any meaningful way, has kind of like, he's allowed her to sort of attach herself back to him. And it's a little kind of portrait of that happening at the scale of society in the late 60s, early 70s, or, you know, when the kind of frontier becomes overrun by authoritarian systems in Mason and Dixon, or, you know, when the kind of brief moment of post-war chaos becomes overrun by military dominance and Gravity's Rainbow, et cetera, et cetera.
I have watched and rewatched the Rudy Blatnoid sequence from the movie like an absurd number of times, in part because I think Martin Short is just fucking amazing in that part. But there's this moment that like it's, for me, it's a specific moment when Dinas, you know, says groovy and Rudy says, you know, like, it's not groovy to be insane. There's something about that, that like, I don't know. I just fucking love that. I love that scene in the movie more than I love anything in either the book, anything else in either the book or the movie. And I don't know how to explain it other than it just makes me very happy. Do you, either of you have a favorite sequence or scene from book or movie?
Some of the Johnny Greenwood score is so good that I didn't realize it was incidental music written for the film. I there were a couple of things that I Shazammed because I thought, oh, this is like an obscure Pink Floyd song that I should know, but I don't, or something like that, right? This is like an alternate version of Careful With That Axe, Eugene that's on some box set that I didn't spring for, and now I need to go do that. But also like the way that, you know, I mentioned this, I think, at the beginning of the podcast, but when Vitamin C by Can comes in during the opening credits, like, there's just kind of a joy to that. You know, that song is like chaotic and joyful and anarchic, but also fucking smart as hell, right? And somehow both like just ramshackle to the point of barely holding together, and also some of the smartest and most complex music ever made, right? I mean, that's Can as a whole, you know? So having that in that moment just underscores it's a tool that Anderson has that Pynchon doesn't, that gives kind of an intuitive richness that is very beautiful and strong. And the same for the two Neil Young songs that are used, right? Like that Journey Through the Past, which is a pretty obscure Neil Young song. I mean, that's on an album that was out of print until about 10 years ago and very, very hard to find until, I guess it might've been on the greatest hits now that I think about it. But the point is just, I think that like the use of music in the film is one of the things that, when I think about this movie, it's one of the first things that I think about.
I really liked in the book, and it's kind of shortened and not emphasized as much in the movie, was the makeup sex between Penny and Doc. I got a stronger sense of the connection between Doc and Penny in the book that made me feel like it was more of a genuine connection than was necessarily there in the film. Partly because of that scene where they kind of get back together and are kind of reinserting themselves into one another's lives that I thought was kind of cool and wanted, you know, that was one reason I'm like, well, maybe there's some kind of future here. And it represented like, to my mind, something that like a vector that for Doc and for Penny, that was more positive and more sustainable than the Doc Shasta kind of relationship, if you know what I'm saying.
It's pretty remarkable what the movie does keep, because there's so much, and a lot of it could have, I think, with a reasonable just a little bit of investment from like a script doctor, like certain roles could have been combined, you know, like, and yet, I still think that it's coherent and, it doesn't feel rushed, but like it does, the movie has this quality to fit it all in where like, you know, there's like a jump cut to like, Doc meeting Jade, and it's some club that that's cut entirely out of the movie. I don't remember the name of it in the book, but it's where he goes to meet Jade after he's been knocked out, And you just sort of cut to Jade and him outside of that club, like in the street. And it's when he meets Coy for the first time. That is really like almost like both the book and the movie are you know, kind of can be kind of confusing. But the way that PTA has to cut directly to moments and have have the thing just happen. I think that it's harder on some characters than others. And I think it's really hard on Penny.
Yeah.
I think she's kind of just basically like she has as much screen time as is like absolutely necessary for her to do the job of her character.
Right.
And Reese Witherspoon's great, you know, but like, I feel you. There had to be some sacrifices.
Right. She was a character that got a little shortchanged in the movie, I think.
Yeah. And you know, Patrick is always out there defending, the DA and
right. Yeah.
Looking out for them, you know?
The fucking, yeah. Kamala Harris all the way, baby.
I'd one last question I had about these. It's maybe a complicated question given how the two of you feel so differently, but like it strikes me that like while I love both the movie and the book, I have harsher criticisms for the movie because of what I feel that it's trying to do. I feel like the movie is almost too faithful to the book, I guess, for the medium of film. And I, you know, I actually like, I had the same thought as you, Hans, that like, I don't know how the movie really like works without also reading the book. Maybe you could disabuse me of that, but my question is PTA too faithful to the book? Does he rely too much on the book, to make the movie really stand on its own and be more than what it is? And tell me if you think I'm wrong on the basic assumption.
I mean, I think that the boy, it seems telling to me that the aspects that we've been criticizing the most vehemently, particularly Patrick, but I think to some extent, Chris, the aspects of the movie that we've been the most critical of are deviations from the book. And so, I mean, I think that if it were the case that the film were too faithful to the book, probably we would be praising the areas where it's deviated rather than criticizing the areas where it's deviated. I mean, I do think that there's a way in which the film is kind of nonsensical on its own, right? And I know a lot of people who enjoy watching it, but who do kind of think of it as something that you kind of stumble through in a haze more so than something that you carefully track. I mean, but I think that that gives it a depth, right? You know, like my parents, who are not Paul Thomas Anderson or Thomas Pynchon fans in any way, shape, or form, have this movie on DVD and have watched it like four times. And I think that you know, what he's done is create something that on the first couple of times through seems like this sort of slipshod ramshackle thing, but that does have a narrative consistency and a certain amount of theme if you are willing to really probe it. The book is a tool that can be used to really probe it, probably the most effective tool that can be used to really probe it. Now, if I think that, you know, like, a really interesting counterexample here, and one I'm a little surprised, actually. I was going to ask at some point why we were talking about, and I'm very happy to have done this, but I was just curious, not in a critical way, why we are talking about this pairing of a Pynchon book and a Paul Thomas Anderson movie, rather than Vineland and One Battle After Another, which is a very recent film based very, very loosely on a Thomas Pynchon novel that is the subject of a great deal of... Yeah, One Battle After Another is based so loosely that I think it's like the loosest possible basis on Vineland. And they're very interesting mirrors of each other in that way because, you know, this is as faithful an adaptation as I can think of other than maybe the Crash Cronenberg. It's essentially a tie. And Vineland, One Battle After Another, it's a very, very loose connection, although still certainly a present one. And I mean, I do think that like One Battle After Another is everything that it's everything that Inherent Vice is not in that it is, I wouldn't say it's very easy to follow, but it is. You can watch it the first time and completely understand how A goes to B goes to C. It has a kind of tense plot suspense that comes from that, it's tight. It's tight and it's watchable.
Don't give anything away because I haven't seen it and I want to watch it.
But One Battle After Another is you can follow it and be suspended by it narratively in a way that you can't on a first viewing of Inherent Vice. And One Battle After Another is, you may feel otherwise, Patrick, because you're probably the most perceptive and nuanced reader of theme in text that I know, right? But like, to my somewhat less perceptive eye, One Battle After Another is very, very, very outspoken about its politics. To the point that it may actually be overread in that way. Like, if you do watch it, I've heard a few, well, if you let me know when you watch it, because there are things I'd be interested in your thoughts about. But anyway, this is a pretty rambling way to say that I think that you have a pretty direct counterexample here in which completely departing from the book does allow you to make something narratively tight and thematically very easy to read. And if that's what you want, I wouldn't watch Inherent Vice, the film, right? But I do, as a counter, think that the incoherence that is partly, I think, you know, Chris, you've made a very good case that the incoherence to a first or second or maybe even third view of Inherent Vice as a film without the book, that incoherence is probably a consequence of faithfulness to the novel. And I think it now having One Battle as a counterexample, you know, there's a way in which the incoherence creates a reapproachable text, right? Because you do kind of feel like there is more to come back for to the extent that it will eventually make more sense if you watch it four times, you know? I mean, that's a very self-indulgent thing to ask for a filmmaker, but there are enough pleasures in the performance and the music and the way that light is used and things like that that I don't mind. I mean, this was the fourth time I've watched Inherent Vice. I didn't mind having done that four times.
I probably agree with Hans. Like, the fact that we are criticizing where the film deviates from the book tells us that... the film, not necessarily that doesn't follow closely enough, but that there are trade-offs that the film had to make, which required losing elements of the book that would have been, would have improved the film, even if they couldn't have been there for some other reason, like length or just unfilmability or whatever. You know, the example being Penny, like a Penny gets a little shortchanged, and that I think that would have made the film better if she hadn't been shortchanged. but it's already
or Einar and Puck.
Oh yeah, like Einar, you know, Puck, a fucking Nazi having sex with his boy best friend Einar. you know, that was a cool element that was left out of the movie, and like I'm not sure how you get them in there without just making it longer, you know, and it's already a hard film at a really long length of like 2 hours and what, 20 or 25 minutes or something like that.
Chris, you and I a couple of times have played, well, not played, but, you know, we both, I think, at least intermittently listen to the Rewatchables podcast. And there's one of the questions that they bring up at the end is prequel, sequel, remake, all black cast, prestige TV miniseries or untouchable. I think you could make a pretty good case for an Inherent Vice prestige TV miniseries.
I think the issue... There's the thing that fights itself, though, and I think that this is why I don't know if it works. Like, Hans, you said that we're critical of where PTA is deviating from the book, but I'm critical of where PTA is deviating from the book to make the things in the book work in a movie. Like, and I say that because I think the issue with a prestige TV miniseries would be the fact that, like, it would be committing to even more of a sort of like a lack of plot, right? So, like, you'd have to change something else or re-exaggerate even further, I think, the kind of the through line sort of conflict tension stuff to make something longer work. And that's where, like, I harped it on it already, but like the scene in which Bigfoot and Doc have a kind of a reconciliation, sort of an ambiguous reconciliation, but there's some kind of attempt there. And then, you know, Bigfoot's sort of unspoken, really throughout the novel, but unspoken to that point in the movie, codependency with Doc and the sort of hippie lifestyle that he overtly says he hates is, I think, you know, very cinematically handled with him eating all of Doc's pot. It's a really cool, striking, interesting character moment. But it's also a character moment that doesn't make any fucking sense. Like, it doesn't really make sense. Like, they're not in a position to be reconciling in that way in the movie. And that's where I feel like the, you know, yes, I'm critical of where the movie deviates from the book, but mostly I think that has to do with the source material and trying so hard to make it work in a movie. I love the movie. I fucking dig it. I wouldn't change a thing about it really. I'm just sort of, you know, putting on, you know, maybe annoying workshop hat here and you know, like, well, if we were judging this solely as a movie, which I can't because I don't think I ever saw it before.
My memory of it is that you read Inherent Vice very shortly after it came out. My memory is, I remember talking to you about this book. I think you might not have finished it the first time.
I did not finish
it
the first time.
Maybe I should
admit
that. Okay.
No.
I didn't know if that was an embarrassing secret to slip on your behalf.
No, I got partway through one of the Lemuria things, and I was like, oh, I can't fucking do this. I was in the book. I was like, I just can't fucking do this right now. And I think I bounced off of the book, and then So I don't know if I read it before I watched the movie or if I watched the movie and decided to reread the book. I think that the latter makes more sense. And I think I didn't really like the movie the first time I saw it. I liked parts of it, but it was like, so it was impossible for me to understand like what the fuck it was without the book. I don't remember for sure though. But all that to say, I do think as a movie, it's not effective without the book. Like that's where I fall on it. And I think that the only way to make it more effective as a movie is to leave the book behind a bit more. And I say that when subjectively, or, you know, really in my heart of hearts, I wouldn't change anything about either of them. So I don't know if what I'm saying has any weight at all. The reason I picked these and not Vineland and One Battle After Another is I have not read Vineland, and I've not seen One Battle After Another, but I would love to do those. I think for probably three times in a row, like, I picked stuff that I hadn't read before for this podcast, and I think at least two out of those three times I wasn't very happy with what I picked. So I decided to pick something I'd read before. I'd love to do Vineland and One Battle After Another, though. Yes, absolutely. Love that movie. Abso-fucking-lutely. Well, and I think Altman is PTA's favorite director of all time. So, it's another connection there. Anything else?
I was happy to reapproach this, and I feel even, you know, at the time, this we've talked before about, like, the ways in which the podcast approach sometimes hurts your experience of a book, right? In this case, it was because, you know, I think the best way to read any Pynchon is about 30 pages a day over as long as it takes to get through it 30 pages a day. For me, that's the best. Others may disagree. And just as a result of my schedule over the last 2 weeks, this had to be more like 100 pages in a sitting on a Saturday kind of approach. And I am glad, like, the conversation has made me feel more warmth and respect and fondness for the book, and recaptured, I think, some of what I lost by having to power through it to read it for a podcast. So I do appreciate that.
I did actually want to second that, Hans. A lot of the times, I'll power through a book in like two days at work, like, you know, even if it's, you know, like the audiobook for this is like 14 hours, and I like to read on double or listen on double speed, so that would have been 7 hours in a few minutes. And normally I would do like a 7 hour book in like 2 days, like 3.5 hours one day, 3.5 hours another. But the content of the book, like, really made me want to slow down and try to, like, just enjoy, like, the line level aspect and some of the line level musings. So I guess is a good word. So I did like closer to like 2 hours over like 3.5 days, and it felt like that was a good amount. Like, I don't know how many pages 2 hours is, because it's like it's a 400 some page book, right?
369 pages.
369, you know, 14 hours. So, you know, I don't know. I'm sure I could do the math, but reading it in smaller increments or chunks was a good idea, is basically all I'm saying.
I did a strange thing. I read through Shasta and Wolfman were back in the picture. So I don't know if that's like 4/5 the way through or 3/4 the way through. And I happened to get an early night to myself. And this is not a movie that Mary Catherine would care for at all. So I'm not going to sit and watch it with her. So I watched the movie and then read the book, and I was nervous beforehand whether I would there would be some bleed through. I wouldn't be able to I'd have a harder time distinguishing what was in the movie from what was in the book. And I actually think that didn't really happen too bad. Maybe because we're doing the podcast pretty shortly after I finished both. But I actually think that would be very pleasurable if somehow you could sort of cheat your brain into kind of getting a little bit confused about what is in the movie and what is in the book. I think there are worse things to suffer. And
like cholera.
Yeah. Yes, yes. But it's just such like the thing I think we've kind of, I don't, it seems like we're all sort of on the same page about this. Hi, Patrick, you're pretty harsh on the movie. It sounds like you're harsher on the movie than any of us, than Hans Rai on anything else.
I mean, it's not like as I said, I enjoyed the movie the second time I watched it after reading the book. Like, I didn't really enjoy it the first time, but the second time I enjoyed it more. But I still would have preferred like some stronger thematic elements from the novel showing up in the film. And, you know, you wonder if like is that a studio choice, like to downplay the critique of capitalism present in the book? Is that something that
the movie would have to do a lot more work to kind of substantiate like the criticism? Like, it's
right,
there's too much going on. Like, I don't know, like maybe
that's fair.
But movie, I feel like, you know, I don't know, it seems like it would be pretty low stakes for the movie to throw a bomb at capitalism in 2014.
Yeah, you would think. I mean, you would think, yes.
I mean, nowadays, fuck, you know.
Nowadays, capitalists are loving, you know, filming critiques of capitalism and making lots of money from that. So, yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I think movie and book are just good hangs. Like, it's you know, this is a movie, a book that you can get lost in, but not too lost, not like Against the Day or Gravity's Rainbow, which I still have to finish. And the movie is, you know, there's kind of mumbling and it's hard to know what people are saying sometimes. But they're both just good hangs. And so I recommend both of them. All right. What are we reading next or watching?
So this is going to get a little complicated. Hopefully not too complicated.
Is it the Sanskrit, holy text that you have tattooed on your torso?
We'll probably have to save that one for the 10-year anniversary in-person podcast. But So I've been, I think I've mentioned a few times before that I was interested in reading Bleak House for the podcast by Charles Dickens. Mm. I do not have it in me to read Bleak House in 2 weeks and feel like I'm doing it a service. Like, I found a copy at a rummage sale and it was 900 pages. And I just thought, yeah, going back right to like cramming things for a pod, I just don't want to do 2 weeks for Bleak House. So I was thinking about, there's an album that I've been, it's once before we chose an album, and it was Dante's Disneyland Inferno by Sun City Girls. And a few months ago, I listened for the first time to Q Roan by John Greaves, Peter Blegvad, and a third person whose name I can't recall. And it uses lyrics as a medium, song lyrics as a medium in different ways than anything else I've ever encountered. And I have been interested in picking it for the podcast. So if it's all right with the two of you, I thought I might rearrange the schedule slightly and do Q Roan in 2 weeks, Bleak House in 2 more weeks, and then have Patrick Chris, you know, basically take my next pick and pull it forward. I don't think that you'll need an enormous amount of time with Q Roan to figure out what's happening. Probably just a couple listens as long as you're reading along with the booklet. So that I sort of wanted to do that so I could, you know, get both those things in without shorting Bleak House. Would that be tolerable?
Yeah,
I'm fine with it.
Okay. And as far as Q Roan, the album, the album is on Spotify, but it is essentially incomprehensible without having the booklet for reference. Mm-hmm. So at some point, hopefully on Monday, I'll scan the booklet and send you a PDF of the CD booklet. I just had a quick look on eBay, and there's only one copy that's under like $40, so it doesn't seem fair to make you both buy the CD. So.
So listen to Q Roan, but also read Bleak House over a 4 week period.
You have 4 weeks to read Bleak House, and at some point in the next 2 weeks, listen to Q Roan while carefully reading along with the lyrics in the booklet as many times as you feel like you need to figure out what's happening or to say fuck this and give up.
All right. This excuse to wear headphones at my home and ignore my children sounds good.
Well, thank you everyone for listening to this, and join us next time for Q Roan, that is KEWRHONE, by John Greaves, Peter Blegvad, and Lisa Herman.